This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
There we go. Thank you so much, Kenza, for those introductions and for those opening thoughts, and thank you to you all for making it through the hangovers out to this first session. I'll preface this with I considered writing two talks for this year, and just starting this with a raise of hands of who is coming into this as a militant atheist and who's coming into this as a religious person. I decided not to do that. I'm gonna give a theory talk that I think will speak to both audiences. But I think we have, we're gonna try and do a little bit of Goldilocksing here. I'll also preface this by saying I don't normally like to start a session off quite this theory-y, but I think on a session on Marxism and religion, we got to start with a little theory because Marxists just have a lot of baggage to work through when it comes to religion. I think we bring bad categories into conversations about religion, first and foremost being the category of religion. We conflate things like theology, spiritual practice, state religion, religious communal life, just like an incredibly diverse assortment of forms of social life into this thing that Christians call religion, and then label it all the opiate of the masses. And it's not just that I think that many Marxists get religion wrong, it's that I think that the way in which they get religion wrong gets Marxism wrong. Here's what I mean. A couple months ago, a fellow Marxist told me that Marxists can't be religious because Marxism is materialist. Okay? I'm sure we've all heard this argument. And it reduces historical materialism to the sort of vulgar materialism of Aristotle. That's not what Marxism is. Our materialism isn't this abstract spirit versus matter thing, right? Our materialism is a method for understanding history. Our materialism's most basic category is labor, which is not matter, right? It's a social process. And this should be the starting point for a proper Marxist understanding of religion. Religion, first and foremost, is a social process. It's what we call the mechanisms that human beings use to fulfill a specific set of our psychic needs. So to condemn religion as un-Marxist is not to critique a specific set of social relations. It's to write off an entire trans-historical sphere of human activity. I noticed looking at the program that this session was listed under the culture category. And I love this because a Marxist condemnation of religion makes about as much sense as a Marxist condemnation of culture. Right? We can critique the category, we can critique certain manifestations of culture, but to critique culture per se is just nonsense. And I think that the same thing is true here. It's just a category error. So let me back up. I want to try and use Marxism to build up a theory of religion that has a little bit less of the baggage that we're talking about. And it starts with clearing up a Marxist concept of ideology. Ideology often gets poorly defined as like a false consciousness or a mixed consciousness, as though hegemony is just a matter of capitalists sort of spoon-feeding us propaganda, and Marxism's goal is just to divest ourselves of ideology and bask in the rightness of the immortal science of Marxism-Leninism. But that's just not how ideology works, right? Ideology is the difference between biological human beings and people, subjects who live in a society. My comrade Barnaby Rain defined ideology in an article as organic encounters with the surface appearance of the world. And when we say that, you know, lived experience matters, or that there is no objective knowledge, you know, subjectless knowledge, that all knowledge is raced, classed, gendered, etc., the more general point that these observations get at is that there is no pre-ideological state of nature that we can retain to, that we can return to. Right? Social life is ideological life for Marxists, I think. So concretely, this means that whenever we participate in the institutions that organize our social life, education, art, sports, media, politics, and religion, we're participating in the process through which the state manufactures consent. And the wild thing is that no one has to tell these institutions or their participants to reproduce capitalist ideology. Class struggle is just so determinant vis-a-vis people's conceptions of you know, what is right, what the relationship to the social order is, what is possible, that subjects of capitalist society reproduce the state ideology on their own, right, on our own, with guidance, prodding, and occasional violent enforcement from the ruling class to keep this process running smoothly. So does that mean that socialists just need to leave these institutions, stop getting education, stop making art, stop watching the news? Of course not, right? We couldn't, even if we wanted to. But more importantly, these institutions are the containers in which the molecular processes that constitute class struggle accumulate. Before, during, and after workers put their hands on the levers of power, workers' movements will be throwing down in civil society, right, in these ideological institutions to determine the terrain and the terms of struggle in revolutionary moments. So yes, religion is ideology. And it is one of these networks of institutions through which capitalist ideology gets reproduced and people are made into capitalist subjects. But this process doesn't start when someone walks into a religious institution. Right? Our whole social life is full of the kinds of rituals that make us into ideological beings. Socialists don't stand aside and condemn education. We struggle in educational institutions for access to a more progressive, more human form of education that enriches our lives rather than preparing us to be productive workers. Socialists don't stand aside and condemn the concept of news media. We struggle for media which tell the stories and lessons of our class rather than the boss's news. And this is the foundation for how we should approach religious institutions too. Not as these fetishized reaction factories, right, or sites of pure ideology, but as just another facet of human social life that will inevitably reflect all of the classed, raced, gendered, etc., tensions and struggles of every other facet of social life under capitalism. Now, so far this is all pretty abstract, and I promise we're gonna talk politics in the discussion section. But I want to clarify what I take this theoretical picture to mean in terms of some of the common arguments that you hear in political spaces around religion. First and foremost, I think that we need to stop thinking about religion per se as causal in regards to various political phenomena. Wars are not fought due to religion. Homophobia does not permeate society because of religion, right? Or specific religions. We know what kinds of structural tensions produce capitalist wars and reproduce cis-heteropatriarchy. There are and have been talks on both in this conference. And we can talk about this in the discussion section if people have questions. Sometimes religious discourses mediate the tensions pushing rival capitalist nation states into conflict. Sometimes they mediate the underlying reliance of capitalism on a homophobic and patriarchal organization of social reproduction. That is, like, religious discourses play a middleman role between the structural dynamics which produce this violence and people's conscious thought processes of why they're homophobic or why they want to go fight and die. But it's only a middleman role because we can easily imagine these structural phenomena finding expression outside of religious institutions in different contexts. I mean, the easy example is that Nazi homophobia was not expressed in religious terms, right, but in sort of ultra-nationalist, ethno-nationalist terms. And over the course of the capitalist era, religious discourses have seldom played more than a tertiary role in the justification of imperialist and inter-imperialist conflict. You know, a lot of my political work focuses on anti-Semitism, as Kenza mentioned, and clearly the church has been an incredibly important structural force behind the institutionalization of anti-Jewish oppression, particularly during the European Middle Ages. Even still, hundreds of years passed between the collapse of the Roman Empire and the rise of anti-Semitism across the European continent as a hegemonic force. Christian doctrine was no more or less anti-Semitic after that several hundred year period than before, but what changed was the material relationship between Christian and Jewish communities, and that only finds expression in religious language after the violence has already started. So I think there are, I think this has two implications for us. First, we absolutely have to reject the new atheist urge to flip literalist readings of spiritual traditions on their head and write off faith traditions due to specific cases of oppressive scripture, liturgy, or doctrine. It's very easy and very lazy to find quotes from scripture or some other textual tradition that say oppressive shit. I know this. I'm a queer Jew, right? But the words, the doctrine, the theology, these are only part, and a small part at that, of the whole social meaning of a community's practice. The political content of a religion, or more accurately, a network of religious institutions and communities, is always going to be reflective of the material divisions within that religious community. Race, gendered, classed, all of these things, right? And it's subject to just an infinite amount of contestation. Some people turn their noses up at this. They say that religious folks are picking and choosing, right? But I think this is beautiful and, more importantly, just an immutable part of how ideology works. Second, while I've spent a lot of time critiquing socialist critiques of religious ideology, this principle is just as damning to religious socialists who tried and claimed that religion per se or certain religious communities or practices are inherently liberatory. People don't resist racial capitalism because of religion. Religious institutions may mediate the tensions which cause resistance, but they don't cause the thing per se. It works the same way in reverse. And this is true for every ideological apparatus, though my assumption is that this point is more obvious. Being an artist doesn't make you a revolutionary, and it doesn't make you a reactionary, right? Watching the news doesn't make you a revolutionary or a reactionary. And contrary to what some of my comrades may think, neither watching nor playing football makes you a revolutionary or a reactionary, okay? These institutions are just what social life is. Pick your sites of struggle, pick your sites of self-care and social reproduction, but we've got to stop treating abstractions like media or religion like the good guys or bad guys of our story. We wind up yelling into the void and missing the opportunity for genuine struggle. Last point. Once we get past this fetishistic view of religion, it actually allows us to engage seriously in the kinds of critiques and struggles that the state of religious institutions today pose to us. Okay. White evangelical Christianity in this country is a fascist-ass network of religious institutions, okay? And it needs to be destroyed. Certain forms of rabbinic authority that run cover for abusers and leave kids without a future are deeply harmful and need to be destroyed. And I'll let Mariam tell you about what kinds of Muslim power structures need destroyed, but there are plenty of those too. The point isn't to run interference for the oppression that happens in religious spaces, right? The point is to get to a place where we can work with the people of our class in those spaces to identify the oppression, identify the class forces and bad actors responsible, and fight for our shit.
I'm not as tall as Jonah, so we're gonna pull that down. Bismillah. What? Oh, yes. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, comrades. Thank you so much for coming out today. As Kenza mentioned, this is a conversation the three of us have been cooking up for the past few years, and it's incredibly nice to have it with all of you. A special shout out to my favorites at Haymarket Books for another year of an incredible conference. I love watching this conference grow every year, and specifically the Muslim presence this year has warmed my heart more than I can say. Some of you, I think, were in yesterday's War on Terror and Establishing Communities of Care talk. That discussion that we had about what we do inside of Muslim communities and the shifts we're seeing as it relates to homophobia and transphobia in our communities, that's the kind of discussion the three of us have been dreaming about having with more than just us in our apartments at 3 a.m. So I hope you join me in that moment, right? Because that's where we are emotionally, is in our apartments at 3 a.m. Because we have about the same amount of sleep. So I'll start here. In January 2017, I piled into a van with my mom and four of the aunties that I had grown up with. These are middle-aged Pakistani women, all immigrants, who had not really played any meaningful particular role in my life, and some of whom I have on good authority voted for Bush twice. And my mom was the organizer, not me. She rallied in her WhatsApp chats that it was necessary that all of us show up and protest and fill the airports and protest the Muslim ban. And so we got into a van and we drove up to Detroit. Me and my aunties chanted refrains like, no Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA. From Palestine to Mexico, the border walls have got to go. And there was a chant that was something about fuck fascism that I cannot remember the exact words of, but I distinctly remember the look on my auntie's face as I willingly swore in front of them, and their cautious and then raucous joining along. We occupied an airport together. In that airport, and for a while after, solidarity between Muslims and other liberation movements seemed obvious and necessary. The landscape today is much different and much darker in Muslim communities. There is a massive right-wing power grab in Muslim communities occurring across the US and the UK, primarily at the breakpoints of homophobia and transphobia. Earlier this year, during Pride Month, a statement titled Navigating Differences dropped, signed by over 200 Muslim scholars and preachers representing, and here I quote the statement, a diverse range of theological schools. I will note that the vast, vast, vast majority of them were Sunni. Navigating Differences statement is a crude sub-4-page document staking out the claim that Islamic sexual and gender ethics are at odds with certain recently popular societal views that queer people ought to have rights and exist in the world publicly. It threatens to work with individuals of all religious and political affiliations to protect the constitutional right of faith communities to live according to their religious convictions. Their convictions, of course, being their right to refuse queer people agreement, acceptance, affirmation, promotion, and celebration. That is what they want the right to deny queer people. There is an endless, truly endless amount to say about how this screed was intellectually and theologically dishonest, blatantly dismissive of non-Sunni scholarship, and the hadith of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam that quite literally acknowledges intersex individuals and gender diverse people as members of his community. I will contain myself from the many things I have to say, and simply say the statement was a naked attempt by scholars to align themselves and the mainstream of American Islam with the Christo-fascist right to access power, particularly because many, many of the scholars are based in Texas. In places like Dearborn, Michigan, Birmingham in the UK, and in my backyard, Hilliard, Ohio, where there are majority and plurality Muslim school districts, Muslim parents have become the face of anti-queer book banning protests and protests to eliminate LGBTQ plus inclusion in schools. I know from personal anecdotes that there are right-wing PACs and right-wing organizers reaching out to community leaders and parents to bring them into the fold on the basis of shared family values. And certainly I say all of this not with the presumption that homophobia arose spontaneously in Muslim communities, but there is a shift, and the institutional powers that be are making bald-faced realignments with the Christo-fascists, joining the vile coalition to eradicate queer life in the United States in a markedly different way. It is new, and it is dangerous. And I wonder if you all have the same instinctual feeling I do as I retell these events, that this is significant to us politically, this matters and this means something. And yet, why do I, and maybe you, have that feeling? Because Muslims make up approximately 1% of the US population. And yet I have this feeling that this more than 1% matters, right? It's not about the numbers themselves. So necessary for the function of capitalism is the labor of the working class. Workers show up to work each day and produce all of the wealth in society. And so then we ask, diligent Marxist feminists that we are, the core question of social reproduction theory: what makes it possible for the worker to return to work each day? What are the processes that make it possible for someone to show up each day and sell their labor power and create wealth? There's things like the bed the worker sleeps in, the food she eats, the friends and family she vents with after a bad day, the water she drinks, the parks she has access to relax and exercise in, and the third space is available to her to fulfill her social and ideological needs. You'll notice that all of these things are central to the functioning of capitalism, because without access to those things, we cannot have access to labor, right? These are central sites of struggle, each and every one of these things. And I think for some of these, that makes sense to us. Housing, food, water rights. But importantly, the third spaces that she has access to fulfill her social, ideological, psychological, and psychic needs. Our access to art, sports, education, and working out have all been so thoroughly privatized in the past few decades. And so of all the third spaces, religious institutions are some of the very last ones left that are still by and large free and accessible to working class communities. And so often in religious institutions, there are also material resources at stake. Religious institutions often provide hours of childcare. Sometimes that's formal, or sometimes it's the general sense that on Sundays or Saturdays, or when people enter religious institutions, that it is not parents alone who are responsible for their children. There's a group of people who are keeping an eye out as kids run through the prayer hall or the pews. Religious institutions often provide education, language learning, food, clothes, charity in times of need, and community in an increasingly alienated world. And so, of course, in a dearth of third spaces that we have access to, with material resources at stake, when there are no working class institutions left for the class to gather in, when there just aren't other places where old school structure-based organizing can even occur, of course, in a climate like that, the battles of ideology and hegemony that occur even in small religious communities have an outsized effect on the experience of the whole class and the political terrain we find ourselves on. That is why it matters, and that's why I want you to care. We have to understand the battles occurring inside religious institutions as battles of class struggle. The working class, as it does in every institution, from the workplace to schools to prisons, struggles for its liberation. And so in religious life too, the working class struggles for its liberation. Movements like the Free Chava movement and anti-talaq organizers, right? Religious women who are advocating inside of their religious communities on the basis of theological and religious arguments, right? Are arguing for their own liberation, their right to be free. They are doing feminist organizing in religious spaces, even if it is not what we who organize in more secular spaces might be able to readily identify. It is feminist organizing. The queer Muslims who are mapping and organizing against homophobic imams and building our own exegesis and theological traditions, this is working class struggle. This is the class struggling. This is not to say that any and all progressive religious organizing is exactly what we as socialists should or ought to be doing, or that those things are not complicated. Just like any other movement, we should engage meaningfully with critique and honesty and our politics as socialists. But in order to do that, we have to see the people in our class who are in these institutions who are fighting for their lives. And so I'll end with this. The amalgam of practices that we call religion, as Jonah said, is a trans-historical sphere of human activity. It predates capitalism, and it will, in some form or shape, outlast capitalism. But under capitalism, it is a terrain of struggle where we contest for power and articulate the necessity of liberation. And it's where fascists rally and weaponize our human need for spiritual healing and our psychic needs for violence. But this sphere of human activity will, again, outlast capitalism too. Because inshallah, one day we will win. Inshallah, we will win. And we will overthrow this wretched, violent, unbearable, grotesque, horrid, wretched, awful, evil system. Inshallah, my mom and all of my aunties will be there too. And when we do, and the task in front of us is to remake the whole world in our image and our honor. I pray that we will take a moment to commune with the divine and with each other, free from the shackles of exploitation and oppression for the very first time, equals in our humanity. Amen.
Okay, thank you both. I am going to, should we turn that mic off? It's probably fine. I'm going to ask both of you a question before we open up to discussion. And that question is that as people marginalized from your religious communities, what does it mean for you to believe that religious institutions still matter for socialists? As people that are marginalized from or in your religious communities, what does it mean for you to still believe that religious institutions matter for socialists?
Yeah, I'll start with some thoughts. And like interrupt me or jump in or whatever. I think for me, a big piece of this, right, is that the people who are marginalizing me from my religious institutions are also engaging in the anti-Semitic assimilationist project, which is trying to wipe my people out, right? What the dynamics that you've seen in the Jewish world are between white supremacy in the United States, the upward mobility of a certain segment of Jews, the creation of this institutional apparatus that has that has benefited from writing poor, queer Jews of color, disabled Jews out of the community. What you've watched is them, in order to gain their access to that power and wealth, allying with the state on precisely the kinds of anti-Semitic and assimilationist programs that the state had been engaging in previously, that those institutions were built nominally to destroy, right? The key example of this is McCarthyism, in which, Jewish institutions, like ruling class white Jewish institutions almost across the board, endorsed the anti-Semitic execution of the Rosenbergs because if you were a communist, you couldn't be a real Jew, right? So fuck that. I think what it means for me is like I am fighting the battle not just within my people, but for my people by contesting for these institutions, right? Like this is a whole existential struggle. That's a piece of it.
And I'll say, I think Kenza's intro talked about this as well, right? That the expansion of Wahhabism, right, has eradicated so much of folk Islam's, for the two of us who are in South Asia, we're watching generationally so much of what Islam looked like in South Asia get wiped clean, right? I think this is in conversation with what Kenza was talking about and what we're losing, right? But I think in this question is the much harder and much more painful part, right? Which is that I cannot attend the mosques in my area. Every time I've gone, it's a homophobic screed that tears me up inside. And I cannot in good conscience ask myself or any of my queer Muslim siblings to do that to ourselves, right? There is a really painful question here where I don't have answers, right, of what it means. I think this is something I believe generally about this political moment. And we say this all the time, right, that this is a moment of experimentation. I don't think anything in this moment, or that I think there are a variety of things we can be trying in this moment. And so what I care about is keeping me and mine safe and figuring out how we fight together. And so I don't have clean answers on, like, the painful underbelly of that question. But I will say that queer Muslims have always existed. As long as Islam has been around, we have been queer, we have been woman, and we have vibrant relationships with the divine in the language of Islam. And I care about preserving that. because I care about my mom, who is not a queer Muslim, right? But Islam defines her whole world. It is in many ways the reason she continues to organize. It's like lib narrative building shit, but it is really cool. She puts in her hours. But I've watched simultaneously the homophobic and misogynistic versions of Islam that she has taken on, and watched that harm her and harm her relationships with the people she loves. And so I care about building an Islam for her and for me and for my people that lets us be free.
Yeah, I'll speak a little bit to that. If anyone was in the War on Terror session yesterday, I mentioned this, but I'll say more about it. Jonah, you said about our own like alliances from within people that we share a religion with, when they ally with right-wing powerful forces, that actually stops all of us from getting free, like what you said about, you know, you're struggling within, but also for. It always makes me think of when Trump was president and I was in school, the Muslim Student Association at our university refused to co-sponsor an anti-Trump rally because of the like 30 organizations that were co-sponsoring it. Maybe two of them were queer orgs on campus. And the thing that really, really got me was that we had been fighting off anti-Muslim attacks for, you know, ever since Trump had gotten into office, and ever since, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years, ever since Black Muslims got to this country. But those people in particular had been in the streets, had seen people flood the airports for us, had seen the necessity for us showing up in solidarity with other people, and were willing to cut off their nose to spite their face. They were willing to not show up for themselves out of their own bigotry. And I feel like that also makes me think of why like class matters here. Wealthy and powerful people within a quote the assemblage that we call religion do not have the same interests as the oppressed of that religious category. I will pass back to you to say anything else about this question.
Yeah, I want to say something really quick, which is that like my talk was like I think fairly neutral on the strategic question of religious institutions, right? Like, And Mariam filled in, I think, some of the good like structural reasons why this is an important strategic question. But I'm gonna be honest here. Like, I was a socialist before I became religious, right? Talking to Hashem is pretty cool. Like communing with the divine is really beautiful. Big Bill Haywood said it. Like, nothing is too good for the working class. Like, I just in honesty, the answer to your question is yeah. This first and foremost, which is that like we deserve this. Like, working class people, queer people, disabled people, people of color. Like, we deserve access to this beautiful resource and this beautiful part of the human experience, which is the relationship to the vine, and that's been taken from us. And so, like, I'm a socialist. When I went into these institutions, that's my job, right? That's I struggle to get that for my people. So, I don't know.
That was a banger. I can't follow. I can't follow.
I've also been compelled by these folks to join in on the discussion, which is why I'm speaking so much.
Hold on. I want to clarify. That is because Kenza has been a comrade and a co-thinker with us in a way that I have been transformed by and Jonah has been transformed by. And so while certainly we gave talks, the knowledge that is with Kenza and certainly with all of you is vast, and I want to share it with all of you.
Great. I think a different answer to this question of like why I still think religious institutions matter for socialists is when the three of us were talking about this one time about the fact that many of us, particularly when radical Black Muslim traditions have been taken from us, many of us Muslims don't have access to much of the revolutionary Islamic tradition or an expansive tradition on gender and sexuality. And we were, you know, talking about all of the hundreds of years of thousands of years of painful reasons that would be, like whether that's patriarchal and racist repression that, you know, keeps scholarship and translation from being expansive, or whether it's the loss and destruction of so many documents across the so-called Muslim world, whether it's scholars who were doing their work not in alignment with the state, and therefore were not resourced by the state to do scholarship. Untranslated work from like myriad corners of the Ummah. Like, we're talking about all of these reasons that we don't have access to these revolutionary traditions. And Mariam said to me that, well, then we're going to have to be the ones to recreate it for the people who come after us. And I think it was the first time that it made me feel excited about the position that we're in instead of the despair that was the predominant emotion, because I was able to see myself in that moment as an agent of history and as a shaper of history instead of a victim of it. And to me, that is what socialism is.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.